You know, when we think about how a story moves from one medium to another, we almost always picture like a one-way street.
Right. Yeah, like a predictable pipeline.
Exactly. A massive best-selling book gets distilled down into a two-hour movie. Or a hit indie film gets padded out into a flashy Broadway spectacle. Mm. It's usually this very straight line from the original source material to a final glossy product.
It is, yeah. It's a well-worn pipeline at this point. You know, you find a piece of intellectual property that works in one specific format, and then you just try to reverse engineer it.
Mm-hmm.
You figure out the mechanics required to make it function in a totally different format.
But every once in a while, you encounter a piece of art that just completely shatters that straight line. It turns that pipeline into something far more complicated and honestly kind of bizarre.
Oh, absolutely.
Think of an Ouroboros.
Yeah.
You know, that ancient symbol of a snake constantly eating its own tail.
Right, yeah.
That endless cycle of something consuming itself to become something new. Well, today's deep dive is about a property that has done exactly that.
Yeah.
We are looking at the wildly fascinating life cycle of Schmigadoon.
Such a great case study.
It really is. We're tracking its transformation from an Apple TV Plus streaming series into a living, breathing Broadway musical. And our mission today isn't just to, like, recap the plot. We are going to explore the actual mechanics of this adaptation. How exactly do you take a television show that was specifically engineered to mock and parody stage musicals and somehow turn it into an actual stage musical?
I mean, it is a masterclass in creative survival. We're analyzing a piece of art that is actively shifting its shape, it's mutating in real time to survive in a completely foreign commercial ecosystem.
And the timing for this exploration could not be better. If you look at the playbills currently being handed out on the streets of New York, the Broadway transfer of this show just began its preview performances a couple of days ago on April 4th, 2026.
Yeah, so it's happening right now.
We are watching this experiment unfold right in front of us.
Yeah.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to truly grasp the irony of what is happening on Broadway today, we really need to establish the DNA of the original story.
Sure.
The television series Schmigadoon first hit our screens back in July of 2021. It was co-created by Cinco Paul and Ken Dario. And the central premise of the show is essentially a very clever love letter to and a very sharp satire of classic theater.
The setup is so distinct, too. You have these two very pragmatic, very modern New York City doctors, Melissa Gimbel and Josh Skinner.
Right.
And they're in a long-term relationship, but the foundation is cracking. The romance is totally fading, and they are really struggling to connect.
Yeah, they're miserable.
They are. So in this last-ditch effort to save their relationship, they go on this couple's backpacking trip. And naturally, they end up getting hopelessly lost in the woods.
Of course.
They cross a mysterious stone bridge, and they find themselves trapped in a magical town called Schmigadoon.
And Schmigadoon is not a normal town.
Not at all.
It is essentially a living, breathing 1940s or 1950s golden age musical.
Right.
And when we say golden age, we're talking about that era of theater characterized by, you know, painted backdrops, sweeping romantic orchestrations.
And just that almost unnatural level of optimism.
Exactly. The townspeople in Schmigadoon are impossibly cheerful, incredibly colorful, and they communicate primarily by breaking into perfectly choreographed song and dance routines.
Which Josh, being an exhausted modern guy from New York, finds absolutely torturous.
Oh, he hates it.
He really does. And even the title of the show is a massive wink to anyone who knows theater history. It's a direct parody of the 1947 stage musical Brigadoon.
Right, where the two travelers stumble upon a mysterious Scottish village.
Exactly, the one that only appears for one day every 100 years.
Yeah.
So the Apple TV Plus series took this concept and ran with it, starring Cecily Strong as Melissa and Keegan-Michael Key as Josh.
Such great cast.
Incredible cast, had a great run, a lot of critical love. But the harsh reality of the streaming era caught up with it. It got canceled after just 2 seasons.
And, you know, in the television industry, cancellation is usually a terminal diagnosis.
Yeah, that's it. You're done.
When a show gets axed, the physical world of that show is erased. The sets are struck, which is, you know, the theater term for literally tearing down the physical environments with crowbars and throwing them in a dumpster.
Right.
The cast and crew are released from their contracts. Everyone moves on to different projects. And the property is just relegated to living out its days as digital code on a streaming server.
It's the end of the road.
Yeah.
Except, in this case, cancellation acted as a catalyst. And this is where that Ouroboros concept really kicks in.
Yeah, it really does.
Because Schmigadoon started as a television show making fun of the tropes of theater. And when television rejected it, it turned around and literally became the very thing it was mocking. It ate its own tail.
What's fascinating here is the sheer refusal to let the story die. The creator, Cinco Paul, didn't just accept the cancellation and walk away. He had actually already mapped out and written a complete third season for the television show.
Oh, wow, really?
Yeah. It was slated to be titled Into the Schmoods. He had already written brand new original songs for it and everything.
That's heartbreaking.
It is. But when Apple closed the door, he made a massive pivot. He realized that if you strip away the cameras and the streaming platform, the natural habitat for a story about a magical musical town is, well, obviously a theatrical stage.
Of course.
So, rather than handing it off to someone else, he took on the monumental task of adapting the book, the music, and the lyrics for a live theater production entirely by himself.
Which sounds completely overwhelming. I mean, you simply cannot take six separate episodes of television, stitch them together, drop them onto the stage of the Nederlander Theater, and expect the audience to stay awake.
No, no way.
The way a story breathes on television is just entirely different from how it survives on a stage. So how did they actually build the anatomy of this adaptation?
Well, it was a very deliberate, phased process of engineering. They didn't just leap straight to Broadway. They started with a workshop presentation back in June of 2024. In the theater world, a workshop is basically a stress test.
Like a prototype.
Exactly. You get actors in a room, often just standing behind music stands, and you read the script out loud to see if the pacing actually holds up without the magic of camera angles and editing.
Right.
And from there, it graduated to a full world premiere in Washington, D.C., at the Eisenhower Theater at the Kennedy Center in early 2025.
And crucially, that D.C. production was directed and choreographed by Christopher Gattelli, who actually designed the choreography for the original TV series.
Yes.
Keeping that connective tissue behind the scenes is huge. But to make it survive the transition from screen to stage, Cinco Paul had to perform some major surgical cuts.
He really did.
According to the source material, he compressed the entire six-episode arc of the first season into one single cohesive narrative. To do that, he simplified the setting and entirely removed certain secondary characters.
Like the parents of the character Doc Lopez.
Right, they just don't exist in the stage version.
And the most significant structural change he made was completely cutting the opening flashbacks.
Wait, really?
Yeah. If you remember the television show, every single episode opened with a very grounded flashback to Josh and Melissa's life back in New York City.
Oh, I remember.
The show used those flashbacks to sort of spoon-feed the audience exactly how their relationship slowly deteriorated over several years.
Okay, wait, hang on. I have to push back on the decision to cut those a little bit.
Go for it.
Taking an axe to those scenes feels incredibly risky to me. By removing the flashbacks and simplifying the setting, doesn't the story completely sacrifice the emotional depth of the main characters?
Well,
I mean, on television, those flashbacks were the emotional anchor of the entire show. They showed you the resentment building up. They explained why Josh and Melissa were so miserable. And understanding their misery is what makes their journey through this relentlessly happy musical town actually meaningful.
I see what you're saying.
Right. Without that backstory, aren't they just two angry people yelling at tap dancers for 2 hours?
That is a highly logical concern. It really is. And it actually exposes the fundamental difference in how human beings consume television versus live theater.
Oh, so?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, think about the physical reality of the audience. When you are watching a television show on your couch, you might have a full week between episodes.
Sure.
Or if you're binge watching, you still have the power to pause the show, go make dinner, check your phone, and come back. Because of those constant interruptions, television writers use devices like flashbacks to constantly remind you of the emotional stakes. It regrounds you in the character's trauma.
Ah, so it's like a built-in refresher course.
Yeah.
Previously on Josh and Melissa's depression.
Exactly. But a live theater audience is in a completely different psychological state. You are physically trapped in a dark room in a relatively small seat for 2.5 hours.
Yeah, you're not pausing to make a sandwich.
Right. Live stage musicals survive on one specific element, and that's constant forward momentum. If you're building a vibrant, magical town full of singing townspeople, and then you suddenly stop the narrative dead in its tracks to transition to a drab, dreary apartment in New York City just to show an argument, you kill the pacing. The live energy in the room completely evaporates.
I guess that makes sense.
To keep a trapped audience engaged, you have to streamline the narrative and trust that the actors can convey their emotional baggage in the present moment without needing a time machine.
Okay, yeah. When you frame it around the physical reality of the audience, the cuts make total sense. You're trading the slow burn emotional backstory for immediate in-the-room momentum. You can't let the balloon touch the floor.
Exactly.
But adaptation isn't just about throwing things away. It's also about expansion. Sinkopal didn't just cut. He restored elements that had been left on the cutting room floor during the TV production.
Mm-hmm.
He also composed brand new songs, specifically for the stage, that never existed in the streaming series.
Yes. The stage production introduces a completely new number called the Picnic Basket Auction, which is designed to utilize the entire company of actors.
Which is such a smart addition. If you think about what Broadway audiences are actually paying for, they want spectacle.
Absolutely.
A tight two-person dialogue scene works beautifully on television when the camera can push in for a close-up of an actor's face.
Mm.
But in a massive theater, you need stage-filling ensemble numbers to justify the scale of the venue. You need 30 people moving in unison.
Precisely. The mechanics of the space demand it. He also added a new duet between the characters Mayor Menlove and Reverend Layton called I Thought I Was the Only One.
Nice.
So what you are seeing isn't just a heavily redacted script. It's a fundamental reimagining that leans into the specific strengths and demands of live performance.
Well, even with all that brilliant engineering, shifting mediums always comes with growing pains. And that brings us to how the professional critics viewed this evolution during that tryout run at the Kennedy Center in D.C.
Oh, the reviews.
Yeah, because as it turns out, my initial worry about the show losing its emotional depth, I wasn't the only one thinking that. The theater critics sitting in the audience felt it too.
They absolutely did.
Analyzing the critical reception from that D.C. run provides a fascinating, unfiltered look at what elements flourished in the transition and what elements essentially got lost in translation. Let's start with the triumphs. The reviewers were largely captivated by the sheer spectacle. Aidan O'Connor, writing for MD Theater Guide, highlighted the show's witty one-liners and described the entire experience as a glorious escape.
It really is an escape.
And Rhoda Fang, reviewing for Vulture, praised the book, music, and lyrics, calling the whole thing a rhapsodic remix of Broadway classics.
The word remix is very apt there.
Yeah.
The show operates as a pastiche, meaning it lovingly stitches together recognizable tropes and musical styles from the past to create something new. And the critical consensus was that Christopher Gattelli's direction maintained a brilliantly brisk pace.
Which is what they needed.
Exactly. The sheer, vibrant joy of poking fun at the Golden Age translated incredibly well to a physical stage.
But then we get into the critiques, and this is where the mechanics of adaptation get incredibly complex, specifically regarding race and satire.
Yes, this is a huge point.
Because we're not taking sides here, but impartially looking at the sources, Rhoda Feng's review in Vulture brought up a profound point about how the show's casting fundamentally altered the text itself. To understand this, you really have to look at the difference between who starred in the TV show and who is starting on stage.
Right. In the original Apple TV Plus series, the lead duo was portrayed by Cecily Strong, a white actress, and Keegan-Michael Key, a black actor.
Right.
That specific, diverse casting was not just incidental, it was a structural tool. It allowed the television writers to embed highly specific meta-jokes and sharp satirical commentary about the history of race in Golden Age musicals.
Right, exactly. The TV script featured explicit lines calling out the concept of colorblind casting. It directly joked about miscegenation. And contextually, miseducations or interracial relationships was a massive cultural taboo and heavily censored in the actual 1940s and 50s theater world that the show is parodying.
Absolutely.
So by dropping a modern black man and a modern white woman into this sanitized, historically white retro setting, the TV show created instant visual friction. The writers used the physical reality of the actors to poke at the underlying racism of the era they were making fun of.
Right. But when we look at the stage production, the role of Josh is played by Alex Brightman alongside Sarah Chase as Melissa. Both of these actors are white.
And because the two leads standing on the stage are white, the visual friction that made those specific jokes function is entirely gone.
And it just doesn't work anymore.
You cannot have two white actors delivering meta-commentary about the taboo of interracial relationships in 1950s musicals. It breaks the internal logic of the scene.
Yeah, it makes no sense.
As a result, those specific lines of dialogue and the sharp cultural critique attached to them had to be completely scrubbed from the stage script.
And as Rhoda Feng noted in her Vulture review, Removing that layer diminishes the opportunities for the show to probe these problems. The satirical teeth of the show were blunted simply because of a casting change.
Wow.
And going back to our earlier debate about pacing and cutting the flashbacks, critics felt that loss too. Naveen Kumar, writing for the Washington Post, specifically mentioned missing the granular details of Josh and Melissa's relationship. So the audience genuinely felt the absence of that emotional grounding.
So this raises an important question regarding the deep, sometimes unintended consequences of adaptation. When you lift a story from a visual medium, like streaming television, and plant it onto a live stage, it is never just about building wooden sets and designing new lighting cues.
No, not at all.
The physical realities of the theater, specifically the demographics of the human beings you cast to stand in front of the audience, dictate the boundaries of the text. A single casting decision can unintentionally reshape the entire subtext of the satire you are trying to deliver.
It's so true.
So what does this all mean for you, the person listening to this? I think it serves as a powerful reminder that casting is never just a talent contest.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't just about finding the actor who can hit the highest note or execute the cleanest tap routine. The physical presence of the actors on stage is the architecture of the narrative. Their identities dictate the kind of social commentary the play is legally and logically capable of exploring. When the demographics shift, the script literally has to change to accommodate the new reality.
It represents a profound shift in the very identity of the show. However, a tryout run in Washington, D.C. exists specifically to identify those exact growing pains.
Right, that's what workshops are for.
The creative team clearly absorbed that critical feedback, fine-tuned the mechanics of the show, and now they are bringing it to Broadway armed with some incredibly heavy-hitting new additions.
Yes, we have to talk about the Broadway upgrade. Opening night is officially locked in for April 20, 2026 at the Niederlander Theater. They have retained the core duo that anchored the workshop and the D.C. run. Alex Brightman continues as Josh, and Sarah Chase continues as Melissa.
And Brad Oscar is also making the transfer, returning as Mayor Menlove.
But the new talent they are injecting into this Broadway run is staggering, particularly when you look at their comedic pedigrees.
Oh, absolutely. Anna Steyer is taking over the pivotal role of Mildred Layton.
Which, if you know anything about comedy, is dream casting.
It really is. Malik Pankhawley is stepping into the incredibly demanding dual roles of Reverend Layton and the Leprechaun.
Wow.
And Max Clayton, who was actually working in the ensemble during the DC run, has been officially promoted to play the character of Danny Bailey.
And behind the scenes, there is a massive force driving this production. Lorne Michaels, who produced the original Apple TV Plus series, is also serving as a producer on the Broadway musical.
The SNL legend himself.
Right. If you consider his legacy with Saturday Night Live, bringing that specific comedy pedigree to a stage show is a huge strategic advantage. It's one thing to deliver a satirical joke into a camera lens 3 feet from your face.
Sure.
It's an entirely different athletic feat to land a satirical joke so clearly that the person sitting in the very back row of a 1,000-seat theater actually laughs out loud. Having producers and cast members like Anna Gasteyer who understand live sketch comedy mechanics is just vital.
It is the ultimate asset. If you're fascinated by how art evolves, paying attention to this production is a masterclass in creative endurance. Mm-hmm. You aren't just watching a standard revival of an old play. You are watching a piece of intellectual property actively shapeshift to stay alive. It hit a massive roadblock network cancellation, and instead of fading away, it mutated. It adapted its pacing, its script, and its casting to survive in a brand new ecosystem.
It's the Ouroboros in real time. We have traced this incredible journey. From a television show paying satirical homage to the 1940s world of Brigadoon, through the sudden heartbreak of a streaming cancellation, all the way to its rebirth as a streamlined, hyperkinetic live stage production.
It's been a wild ride.
It really has. It had to sacrifice the slow-burn emotional backstory of its main characters, and it had to recalibrate its satirical bite based on the realities of its casting. But it survived the process. It made it to the Broadway stage.
It did. But the wildest part of the story is that the evolution might not be over.
Wait, really?
Yeah, there is a final lingering thought here that stretches far beyond the current run at the Niederlander Theater. According to the source material, Cinco Paul's ambition doesn't stop with this one production. He's publicly stated that his ultimate goal is to adapt all 3 seasons of his television concept for the stage.
Which is wild, considering we know he has already fully written the unproduced 3rd season.
Precisely. But consider the thematic trajectory of the television show. Season one, which is what is currently on Broadway, was a bubbly, bright, colorful parody of the golden age of musicals.
Yeah.
Even with the satire, the baseline tone is cheerful. Season two of the television series, however, took a massive, jarring pivot.
Oh, I remember this.
It abandoned the 1940s entirely and parodied the darker, much edgier, and highly cynical themes of 1960s and 70s musicals.
Mm.
We are talking about the era of Bob Fosse. Shows like Cabaret, Chicago, or Sweeney Todd.
Oh, wow. That isn't just a different setting. That is a complete psychological shift.
Yeah.
Going from optimistic tap dancing to cynical, dark cabaret is a massive leap.
Is night and day. So imagine this scenario. If this current Broadway run is a massive commercial hit and they decide to push forward and adapt the sequel for the stage, how is a live theater audience going to react?
That's a great question.
How do you market a stage sequel that entirely abandons the bright, cheerful escapism of the first show in favor of a gritty, cynical, sexually charged tone?
That might be the ultimate test for commercial theater. Does the modern Broadway crowd actually want to be challenged by a shifting, dark, cynical satire? Or did they just pay top dollar for a ticket because they wanted the comfort of happy, escapist tap dancing?
Exactly.
When the snake starts eating its own tail, the real mystery is whether the audience will actually stick around to watch it finish the meal. It is a fascinating tightrope walk, and we will definitely be watching to see how Broadway responds.